KPCW News Time now, 8:15. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Joining me now in the studio from Park City Municipal, I have Kyle Moniz, and from Summit County, Kelsey Christiansen. They serve as their respective stormwater managers hired to help both municipality and the county comply with federal stormwater regulations. Good morning.
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 So Kelsey, you, this is a new position for you. You're kind of taken over from where Kyle left at the county?
Yeah, pretty much. They created a new position, the stormwater manager, to just focus on stormwater for Summit County. And that's when I took over a couple months ago.
Okay, so what's your background?
I went to Washington State and got a degree in environmental engineering. And I was actually working in Durango, Colorado in the oil and gas industry for a while before moving to the state of Utah. And I worked for the state in water quality, writing stormwater permits, and then I moved to Park City recently and took a job with the county.
Okay, and then Kyle, again, you also have a similar background?
My background is in actually construction management, and I was originally hired with the county to do more engineering, construction type stuff, and then took on the stormwater role there as part of other responsibilities, so... Mm-hmm.
All right. So both of you are now responsible for managing a permit from the state for what's called an MS4 stormwater permit. Can one of you explain what that is?
So that stands for Municipal Separate Storm Sewer System. Much easier to say MS4. It's basically to comply with the Clean Water Act. The EPA hands down requirements to the state, and the state designates different counties, cities, or a couple different entities like the U and Hill Air Force Base are also MS4s, and their role is to comply with these clean water standards.
So is every city and county in the state then required to have positions like this?
It depends on population, and it depends on if the state delegates them. The state delegated Summit County about 4 years ago, and I think Park City about 3. Is that right, Kyle?
Yeah, they were designated at the same time. Park City asked for a one-year extension to that designation. So we're 1 year behind in the time frame.
Now, the difference, I think, is that Park City also instituted a stormwater utility fee, which I know helps to pay for your salary as well as some other projects. Summit County hasn't instituted that yet.
We haven't. We do have an MS4 permit fee. So for all construction sites, they need to pay this fee that goes towards my salary. And we're looking to adjust that in the future.
Higher.
Right.
So can you talk about some of the projects then that you're working on that this money is going towards? I mean, how what are we doing to... Part of the problem, I think, though, with both entities, of course, is the old mine tailings that we've got from the mill operations, which start, of course, from the hills of Park City here, kind of flow down Poison Creek and then make their ways into both McLeod Creek and Silver Creek. So do we need to start at the top of the mountain?
That's one aspect of the stormwater. I mean, a big part of the stormwater program is the building. So we have all this development going on, and they all need permits, and they all need to be inspected, and they all need to be maintaining their sediment, essentially, on site. So that's a big part of it. The mine tailings is a whole nother aspect of the stormwater.
Okay. So this is just stuff that's running off into the stormwater drains from new construction as dirt gets tilled up?
Yeah, the city was able to, I would say, negotiate with the people at the state about the water quality coming out of the mines. We're not necessarily required to treat that. I think they sort of identified that as a historical problem that, has a lot of challenges, and it's not necessarily on their radar as far as something that has to be corrected now. Obviously, it does create long-lasting problems for us. There are what they call a TMDL study on all the different watersheds, and Silver Creek collecting most of that mine water has the most sources of impairment. And as part of this program, we're not supposed to contribute to the baseline impairments of those. So It does set up some challenges, but we're not necessarily reversing the mining effects. We're just trying to mitigate our impact on them right now.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that new construction does to the stormwater if it's not mitigated?
Well, it creates a change in the watershed. It increases the impervious area of a particular boundary, a piece of land. And what that does is that creates more of a impact on the streams when you have more runoff water that would initially be going into the ground, being infiltrated, now doesn't obviously go into the ground because there's an impervious surface. So a lot of these goals, a lot of the long-term goals that this program has is to keep stormwater on the site, recharge groundwater, have different standards to clean that water, so to speak, remove pollutants that it may pick up as it runs across a developed parcel.
Especially like parking lots when we're talking about like radiator and oil and fluid, all that.
Yeah, because obviously most native vegetated pieces of ground don't really contribute to pollutants. There is some natural erosion, but you can justify that as a natural part of the cycle of water and eroding and things.
Yeah. So it's up to the developer then to come up with these stormwater clean. And what sounds like we've got some kind of like mini treatment plant at each development then? Is that what's happening?
They mostly have best management practices like straw wattles or silt fence to capture the, mostly with the new development, you're looking at sediment. You don't want the rivers to turn into chocolate milk. So they want to stop that sediment before it hits the streams.
Okay, you can even see it out here in front of KBCW, just those straw bales.
Right.
Is that what it's doing?
Yeah. You'll see them all around if you start looking.
So there's temporary measures that are put up during construction. And then one of the big pushes now is to have what they call long-term stormwater management. Usually it's done through, like, detention ponds. There's also a big push in subsurface infiltration where instead of the water leaving the site through a storm drain, it's actually sent down into the ground in that site. What that does is that essentially removes all those pollutants from ever reaching a waterway.
Okay. So are we complying then with the federal regulations for stormwater?
I would say compared to a lot of other municipalities, we're definitely ahead of the curve. The county and the city have, I think, been very proactive over the last even 10 to 15 years in implementing requirements before they are even required to.
They are kind of like moving targets. So I think that Summit County and Park City is ahead of the rest of the state as far as stormwater. But
and if you weren't complying, then what? You just get fined? Is that how it
Well, we'll get audited, both Park City, because we both have permits, Park City, Summit County, UDOT has one, and so does Snyderville Water Reclamation District. So we'll get audited, and they'll tell us essentially what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong, and then we fix what we're doing wrong.
So does this really apply to just all new construction? I mean, what about the existing residential and commercial areas? Is that not an issue, or are we trying to...
It is an issue, but it's, like I said, a moving target. So we're trying to our best to do what we have with what's existing. We, like I said, we're fairly new to the stormwater permit designation. Like down in the valley, they've been doing this MS4 program for over 20 years.
Okay. I know that the county council very concerned about how stormwater issues affect the major source of the Weber River. What are we doing, anything specifically for that?
Well, we're making all new construction get permits to help with the sediment. We're doing this, a part of our permit is public outreach, so that's kind of why we're here, is reaching out to the public. We want to focus on fertilizer usage and just salt usage and all these contaminants that when it rains, all of that will go into the waterway, so we want to be conscious of that.
All right. Is there kind of a list of residential best practices somewhere?
Summit County has some pamphlets that we hand out. We'd like to do more. We're going to start posting on Facebook and Instagram more public outreach and things that people can do as a household.
Yeah. What about for Park City?
Yeah, we have some pamphlets and information on our website. It's on the public utilities link. We have some specifically targeted to different user groups, things like dog waste, and then, you know, just residential good housekeeping practices. You know, the gutter is not necessarily the trash can. That's what we'd like to express to people.
Yeah. And I mean, you can't see it now, but I mean, I see the city's got a street cleaner and it is out a lot. Is that part of this stormwater?
Yeah, they are running both the street sweeper and the vac truck almost daily during the summer season. We're very closely with those guys, and they have just about cleaned the entire storm drain system throughout the city. They anticipate being done with the initial cleaning, I think, at the end of the season. And it's an ongoing process. We pick up a lot of water up here, which obviously picks up a lot of sediment debris, especially in the spring, and it you know, they have to stay on top of it, and they're pretty good.
Yeah. Kelsey, is the county doing something similar with the streets?
Yeah, we do regular maintenance. We have a stormwater hotline, and we'd like people to use it. So if you see some stormwater issues, we'd like you to contact us. It's 435-336-3929.
Okay. Anything else you two wanted to mention?
We can say the city also has a stormwater hotline. It's 615-5307. And okay. They can call and leave us a message, and we'll try and get right on it.
Okay. Hey, Kyle. Kelsey, thanks for coming in. News time now, 8:34. Good morning. Well, the Moab City Council and Grand County Council recently approved a moratorium on new construction of overnight accommodations. It has caught the attention of state lawmakers. Joining me now on the phone to talk about why the councils did this and what kind of trouble they're in is the mayor of Moab, Emily Niehaus. Good morning.
No worries. I can hear you just well enough. I'll just be real quiet so I don't miss a question.
Well, first,
what's the weather like in Park City this morning?
Well, our windows are boarded up. We're in the middle of construction here, or just starting construction, so I can't see outside, but it's supposed to be sunny. First, tell us why the city council, the Moab City Council, took such action back in February, I believe.
That's right. So what we in Moab are trying to do is get organized. We have, in our commercial zone, allowed overnight accommodations pretty much all throughout our commercial zone. And when you have hotels as your highest and best use, the other commercial uses take second seat. And so what we're trying to do with our actions is encourage diversification. But also, we're not saying no to new hotel development. We're saying, how can we mix those uses together? So we're looking now at standards that could really do a great job of blending use, so that we can have both overnight accommodations and office space and daycare space and other critical uses in the commercial district that are kind of taking the back seat.
Well,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, so certainly the law allows for a 6-month temporary zoning ordinance, as they're called. So this was done in February. So you've reached the end of that, or I mean, because you can't put on a permanent moratorium, or can you?
You cannot. And yeah, the moratorium is no longer in effect. In fact, we did changes to our code prior to the expiration. And so we've been out of the moratorium for a while now.
Okay, so that was what you did in July. You amended those zoning laws to remove overnight accommodations as a land use, and then, again, putting in this kind of mixed-use zoning?
That's right. And so what we're doing is now working with our planning commission to really have to reintroduce overnight accommodations with this mixed-use notion. And I just want to say, too, that we've had a lot of support during this process from our legislators, from the governor's office, from local developers. I think we're all on board in making sure that we're accommodating for a wide variety of commercial use.
Yeah, but certainly, I mean, what I had read in the Salt Lake Tribune, I was surprised to read that you were summoned to Salt Lake City for 2 days of meeting with the Governor's Office of Economic Development, as well as the Governor's Deputy Chief of Staff and Utah Senator.
Summoned is a very dramatic word. And yet, we did set up critical meetings so that Moab could tell our story. And those meetings were fantastic because what we've been doing is telling our story, sharing, you know, why we're doing what we're doing, and really garnering a lot of support, for it. So, our legislators and the governor's office understand what we're doing and are supportive.
Okay, because there was some talk that perhaps there would be some legislative intervention, and we certainly have seen that in the Park City area when Park City implemented school district impact fees. I mean, that was recalled by the state legislature, and all of those funds had to be returned. Is that what you're feeling like, though, that the state may intervene itself?
Well, you know, politics are negotiation, and I certainly don't want to operate in a place of fear. I want to operate like my legislators are my partners in this. And I think that's why we've been trying to have critical meetings and talk to the press. And I'm so grateful for this interview this morning so that we can share our story. But I have to share one more thing, one more sort of false narrative that's coming out as a result of our just getting organized and dealing with our infrastructure. And that is that, just like using the word summons, people are saying, oh, Moab is crazy full and overflowing with tourists. And while sometimes you feel the congestion, particularly on very busy holiday weekends, there's still capacity in our accommodation sector, with restaurants, with waiting in line to get into arches. There are critical times, like holiday seasons, like I said, where it's very busy, but there's still a lot of beautiful solitude and room for people to come and enjoy Moab. So while it feels dire, what you read in the paper feels like, oh, we're in a dire place. I think where that is coming from is just that we in Moab are struggling with affordable housing. We're struggling with childcare because we don't have enough childcare providers. So shout out to any childcare providers looking to expand their business in Moab. We'd love to have you. We are just, as locals, feeling like we need to do our job to build our own capacity. And so I think that that's where that message is coming from. But I just wanted to make it clear to especially folks in Park City, and it's true, you know, I hear it from friends that come down and play in Moab, that there's still plenty of room for playing. It's just busy weekends are busy.
Yeah, so is it during the week we don't see those traffic jams along Main Street?
Not at all. I mean, you know, we're coming into what was UEA weekend, right? Mm-hmm. So today and tomorrow were typically the days that schools closed down and families went on vacation. And we're expecting to have the same amount of congestion. So today's a Thursday. We're expecting to see a really busy Moab today. And that's okay. It's just real busy. It's so funny when I think of Disneyland, and not at all am I comparing Moab to Disneyland, but when I think of Disneyland, you stand in line for rides, right? There's still so much, that you can do in Moab where you're not waiting in line. Arches is just one of many one of many recreation opportunities, and the Bar M trails for cyclists. They're open, and there's always a space to park up there. There and then also within Sound Flat, other BLM areas. Campsites get pretty full because, you know, people love to camp and they love to have a restroom. But again, on busy weekends, during the week, it's pretty easy to find a campground or a campsite.
And certainly much like Park City, what used to be Moab's affordable housing now is part of the Airbnb, VRBO nightly rental market. Is that causing some problems as well for you?
No, our problems are capacity. We just don't have enough housing stock. Here's the reality. We have fiercely protected our residential zone, and so we do not see illegal overnight accommodations. We've said no overnight stays in our residential zone, and we've been, you know, fierce to protect that. We don't see a lot of abuse of that. Neighbors are very quick to report if they think something like that is going on, and we are quick to enforce because we fiercely protect our residential zones. In our commercial zones, overnight accommodations, they're great. People need a place to stay when they come to Moab. And so we definitely support the overnight accommodations that are legal, that are paying their taxes, and that are supporting visitors when they come to stay in Moab. We have not had the Airbnb battle. Now, if we are not given the opportunity to continue to enforce that, then Moab's going to have a big voice in that fight. But right now, we've just fiercely protected our residential, and we are reshaping our commercial overnight accommodations.
Okay. Again, anything else you want to tell us about the issue, Emily?
Well, I just want to say that we're certainly not alone in failing infrastructure. We're certainly not alone in figure out affordable housing. And we all in our state have an opportunity to come together and tackle these issues. One thing that I want to mention about Moab that really isn't reported is just how very remote we are. So while everybody's having a housing crisis or a lack of affordable daycare or housing, in most communities, you can sort of hop next door. You can look at surrounding communities to get your needs met. And down in Moab, we're so rural. So we are 2 hours from Walmart, 3 hours from Costco. And that actually makes a big difference when you think about building housing. The transportation costs alone for our materials goes up. And so our challenges are a bit unique in that we are a remote location, but I think that's also what makes us such a fun destination for recreation. So that's the only other challenge that I'd love for people to just kind of wrap their heads around and understand, especially for our visitors when you get here. If you're going to, I made a joke the other day, I don't know if I should say this over the airwaves, but if you're a woman and you want to, if you need to buy a bra, the only bra you can buy in Moab is a sports bra. So come to Moab prepared. And just understand that the remoteness, while it may feel like the resources, we're trying to expand our capacity to offer more resources, that is also our charm.
Okay. Mayor Emily Niehaus, I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
The Snidaville Basin Planning Commission on Tuesday took up the mixed-use zone as well as a preliminary discussion on what is now being called the Dakota Pacific Project, formerly known as the Park City Tech Center. On the phone, I have the chair of the Snidaville Planning Commission, Melina Stevens. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So it's really kind of an unnamed project at this point. We had heard that the developer, Dakota Pacific, cannot use the word Olympic in its development, so trying to figure out what the new name will be. But Generally, I think the Planning Commission thought that the plan is cool. The proposal includes concepts for housing, hotels, and a gondola connecting Kimball Junction to the Utah Olympic Park. But commissioners said that they need information. Anything in particular?
Well, this was a preliminary look at the project. So with that, I mean, this is a large-scale project, obviously, and they're asking for a lot of additional density. And so with this, this is just the overview of the project, what they're thinking, and allowed us to give some initial kind of 30,000-foot feedback to them as far as, you know, one of the things they're interested in was they explained that their housing that they're proposing is going to be a mix of market rate, attainable, and affordable. Well, really, for us to be able to understand what that density is going to look like, if there's going to be enough affordable housing to really warrant an increase in density, we need to know what those numbers are. There's also some questions we had about the timing of the project, as far as a project that large is going to have to be phased with development and what that's going to look like as far as the especially the benefits to the area and the transportation solutions that they're proposing, as well as some of the housing and retail and different things like that. So those were some of the major questions that we had. By no means is this a final project or are we anywhere close to an approval. We're really kind of viewing this process similarly to how we viewed the Canyons Resort Spa Major Amendment, as far as really digging deep into it, taking our time, and making sure that we're doing it right and that it will be a benefit to the community and not something that's going to increase issues that we have.
Yeah. The project proposing to increase density from about 1.3 million square feet to what's approved to more than 1.9 million square feet. How do we justify this, given the provision 2.3, as it's known, of the development code, which basically requires no new density unless there's a compelling community benefit?
Well, and with that, I think that's, for me and for the other commissioners, one of the primary things that we're looking at. And that was not something that we're really digging into at this first meeting. Again, this first meeting was really to look at what the project is, why they are proposing what they're proposing. But that is one thing that we did discuss during the meeting, is that for an increase in density, they're going to have to focus and justify through 2.3 that there's going to be a countervailing public interest to the increase in density and why that is important for them to have that. So we, again, are not making any decisions at this time.
Yeah.
But that we will be absolutely looking at this project through the lens of 2.3 if we award any additional density.
You know, 20 years ago, we didn't think much maybe about bike paths or open space or workforce housing, and we approved developments without, you know, requiring community benefits like that. I guess, so why are we considering even talking about one more residential unit in the Snyderville Basin when in 20 years, a tech park may be exactly what this community needs, a place where companies will want to do business, you know, where traffic and congestion in Salt Lake is unbearable. A tech park that can more, you know, than offer more than just service industry wages.
Absolutely. And I think that was the thought process with Boyer Tech Center initially, with a lot of the development now being focused down in Silicon Slopes. It appears that that's not as viable of an option, especially with our housing prices increasing. It makes it challenging for people to be able to sustain that type of growth. Also, it could have increased traffic impacts from at least the initial traffic studies that we were shown that Dakota Pacific has done, which, again, we will be digging deeper into, that their proposed project would have less of a traffic impact than a tech center because of the inload and outload during key times. So we are looking at all of that and with the tech center, but the project that's in front of us is not currently a tech center, and so we're looking at this current project.
Yeah, and I understand that's your job, but I guess as we think about planning, you know, where does a tech park go if, in fact, that's something that we would need or want in 20 years if it's not here?
Well, in 20 years, there's likely going to be sites within Park City and the Snidervale Basin that are ready to be redeveloped at that point. And so there's likely several spots where something like that could go in the future, depending on how, as a community, we decided we wanted, needed, and depending on what developers were willing and able to produce. So I don't think that if in 20 years that was something that this community wanted and needed, I think we would have options that wouldn't necessarily preclude.
All right. And Planning Commissioner Ryan Dickey raised an interesting question. Will the affordable housing that they build make a dent in our current demand for units, or will the units just be taken by the employees that the Dakota community is creating? I guess you don't really know that answer until you know how much affordable housing will be there, huh?
And that's absolutely right. Until we look at the numbers as far as affordable housing and also the employee generation that will be created through the Dakota Pacific project, they are focusing a lot. They do have some retail projects, and they are proposing a hotel. However, it's not a retail-intensive project because of all of the retail that's currently immediately adjacent in that area. So a lot of the workforce, in theory, could go towards, you know, Redstone and New Park and some of those other areas, as well as maybe canyons, but we really don't know that until we look at the numbers.
Finally, I just wanted to ask about the gondola. I mean, is this just about a future Olympic Games? I mean, why do we need a gondola to the Utah Olympic Park? I mean, we have 20 times the number of cars being parked at our local resorts.
I think with the gondola, it's not just about the connection to Olympic Park. I think with a potential Olympic Games, that would be helpful if we did, in fact, get that bid. But a lot of it is traversing 224. Right now, 224 is separating the Kimball Junction neighborhood, and there's not great ability on foot to really get from one side to the other. You have to cross 224, and it can be dangerous and intimidating for people. And so trying to increase different modes of transportation so that not only, you know, cars can get from one side to the other, but people really can live, work, and play in that area without having to get into a car every single time. So it's to decrease some of our traffic impact.
The neighborhood mixed-use zone has kind of turned into a sort of whoops. The developer, Henry Sigg, had asked for a decision last night. The Planning Commission spent some time hammering out language for a motion to approve. Then someone pointed out that the item hadn't been noticed and legally you couldn't vote on that. Do you think that the commission is ready to vote on an approval for this at your next meeting?
Based off of our conversation last night, it looked like, I mean, we've been working on this zone for over a year off and on in different meetings. We feel, at least based off of the five commissioners that were present last night, that we've gotten to a point where we have the ability with some changes to the language to be able to make a motion. So it's likely that in the next meeting that will take place. Will there be a couple of changes that's possible after our attorney indicated that we could not at that point make a motion? There were a couple of additional questions that came up, so I would anticipate there being additional conversations prior to any sort of decision.
And again, this vote would be on the mixed-use zone, not Henry Singh's specific project. That's correct, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I wanted to ask you also about the Ruby Tuesday site. In just the minute we have left, you were open to discussing changes to allow a car rental business here. Of course, Ruby's going out of business, Cafe Trio trying and also failing there. You initially said you didn't support a change in use, but you did change your mind after Tuesday's discussion. How come?
So initially, my viewpoint of the project was that's kind of a strange ask in that area with the retail, the Whole Foods across the street, the hotel. After hearing from the applicant in their reasoning why and looking at the site, the foliage that surrounds it, how it's tucked away, the actual decrease in intensity of use with how many people would be coming and going from that site, and the infrastructure that's already there, it seems like that might be a sustainable business for that area, as opposed to, as you stated, restaurants that are having a rough time there because it is kind of tucked away. It's a little off the beaten path. So one of the things that staff asked through this is having, is this business, you know, is it better to have this business here or a vacant building? And it sounded from the commission and also from my opinion after hearing from the applicant and reviewing all of the information was that it could be a great benefit to have a car rental that's in the area close to all of these services that could in some ways maybe decrease some impacts so people can car share versus everyone having to own two cars.
Okay. Melania, thank you for your time. I've got to leave it there. KPCW.